And welcome back, everybody. Thank you for joining us here in the second segment. We are talking with Kerry Bolton about his book, The Psychotic Left, but also, of course, a number of the other titles that he has available out there for you. Very interesting in terms of a different view, not only, of course, on the revolutions, but also basically where we are today and our liberal democracies and progressivism and basically where this is going. And you got into a very interesting aspect there, Kerry, as well, in terms of how they're seeking to use multiculturalism. It's really part of the old dialectic, again, as you mentioned, of creating conflict to be able to, get a desired outcome, basically. And this is something I feel a lot of people that are into conspiracy and whatnot are actually fundamentally missing that point, because for some reason these issues are those that are blinded to people, because they unfortunately they have been politically programmed. They have a very politically correct kind of attitude to a lot of things. And I think that that's evidence in itself of how successful the programming in the West has been for us to, for example, to even look after our own interests or being, pro-European, et cetera. And we get the same old criticism flinged at us when this comes up. But it's, how has it been so successful, do you think? I mean, I contemplate this all the time. It's just amazing to me how they've managed to destroy so much of Europe as they now have done in such a short time without a real solid, resistance kind of building to this.
Well, I guess that I think the Western peoples have got a sense of fair play and wanting to do the right thing, wanting to do the moral thing. And so when one's morals are actually reshaped by one's enemies, that's one's defences really undermined at the most fundamental level. I mean, we've been told for decades that, any concept of Western self-assertion or pride, is an evil thing. And, of course, the obvious point is that Hitlerism, has served that purpose rather well, with all the attendant guilt associated with that. And any mention of anything nationalistic or pro-Western, pro-European, or anything of the type is automatically related to Nazism. And of course, one recalls in horror of any such suggestion. And once again, it places anyone with right wing tendencies on the defensive. I think it's a moral question. The other point too related to it is, as I mentioned before, I think we're in a cycle of decline. And I think if we look back in other periods of other civilizations, they went through fairly much the same epochs of self, they reach a period of self-doubt, and their own moral foundations are undermined one way or the other. And I think it's largely something that's an organic development, the human body goes through the process, or any organism really goes through the processes of youth and vigor and maturity, then starts reaching periods of decay, senility, and decline. And I think the Western world has reached that organic cycle of decline. And I think what a lot of people miss is that conspiracies, etc., aren't the cause problems, they're the symptom of problems. These situations wouldn't arise unless the cultural organism of the West wasn't flawed and weakened to start with, just like the human or any other organic body. It succumbs to disease and death because the organs and cells start to weaken.
Yeah.
I see an analogy there, basically. And
it's our immune system, basically, right? That's what's the problem here.
Yes. Good way of putting it.
Yeah.
And, people talk about the influence of the Jews, etc., for instance. But, Jews wouldn't have that influence unless there's a fundamental flaw in the cultural organism.
What do you attribute that to? Have you thought more about that in terms of why this happened? I mean, I know a lot of some people they do tie in Christianity into it. They recognize that there was a destruction of our traditional you know, cultures that have existed for many thousands of years, and here's something very, very new that comes in a very violent way, for example. I don't know, where are you on that page?
Yeah, well, you know, I follow what Spengler has to say, and that, you know, we just really go through periods of growth and decay, and during the period of decay, it's the period where money rules, and so anyone that has the money has the power, you know, and in previous cycles, it's where, you know, concepts like heroism and the martial ethos rule. Western civilization itself, I think, owes most of its ethos and existence to Christianity. You know, I think you can't really separate the two, whether you're even an atheist or not. Rivilo P. Oliver, the American scholar, he was, you know, an atheist, but he wrote a book, Christianity and the Survival of the West, at one point of his career, saying that no matter what one's religion, one cannot ignore the fact that Christianity has been for a thousand years synonymous with the West. So I don't think really you can put our plight down to the disruption of the West through Christianity, for instance, when I think it's basically that was our founding religion. What it did is provide the leavening for, you know, the previous chaos of the old Roman and pagan world, and created from those traditions something new. But you see, I tend to think that Protestantism and the Reformation had a certain negative impact on Western civilization. I mean, I'm not a Catholic or any, I don't belong formally to any religion at all, but I think trying to look at it just from a objective or detached outlook, you know, Protestantism basically brought in the concept of allowing money to rule, you know, through, I mean, Henry VIII destroyed the old property class and brought in laws more freer towards usury, etc. And, you know, the Protestants basically had a more lenient attitude towards usury than the what the Catholic rulers did, who regarded usury as sin, you know. So I think we have to look at some of those questions as well in regard to our predicament.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree with that. I think the Reformation, well, I see it as a long progression. I mentioned this before, but in terms of, you know, moving from basically having something which is in constant re-evaluation, you know, even the Catholic Church, you have the ecumenical councils, and it's a huge aspect of, you know, thinking and rethinking the ideas. And that's that's Western as well, right? It's a good thing in that. It's a philosophical discourse. There are a tendency to try to update to the times. I get that as well. But at the same time, it feels like it's almost that when that goes on overdrive, we miss the strong, you know, fundament that we need to stand on in order to build a civilization, you know?
Yeah. And, you know, Spengler called it the Faustian urge, or the Faustian impulsion of Western man. And, you know, that's got, you know, a downside to it. So there's two sides of the coin. I mean, our Faustian urges, you know, you could argue that the technocracy involved is basically destroying the planet. And even Spengler said, well, you know, the days of great Western art, music, literature, etc., have gone, and all we can look forward to now is the days of great Western technocracy. And, you know, I think it's a fairly sobering thought. You know, man tied to the machine. He regarded basically the new warrior as the technocrat, the technician.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, while I'm on Spenglerian, I sort of am repulsed by the idea of an overly technocratic society, and you know. More lately, I've even thought in terms of, well, when a civilization reaches that peak, I think we've basically passed the point of return whereby the West, Spengler looked for and Yockey looked for a sort of last hurrah of the West, and what Yockey called a Western Imperium. But I think what we got instead, especially after the Second World War, was the victory, not a resurgence of what they thought of authority and Western ethos, but an imperium of money. You know, I think our whole culture was distorted away from any sort of destiny that they envisaged, and the destiny we have is that of money, and the leading power is not some European nation, but the USA, with all that that implies. And possibly, like in previous cycles of history, what we can only hope for now is maybe a resurgence of Russia to provide a new impetus and a new civilization, sort of post-Western civilization, that might be able to incorporate a synthesis of you know, the best of the West with what Russia has to offer.
So you're kind of pessimist at the end of it. Because to a certain extent, obviously, if it's a cycle, there's really, well, there's things you can do to try to, you know, affect it or whatnot. But really, it's up to something more bigger than ourselves to do that. Meaning, it's kind of we have to just go along with the ride, really, right? Or can we do something?
Yeah,
there?
Yeah. That was basically why people like Spengler and Yockey were often rejected and still are as being pessimistic. But you know, it's like saying, well, we're all going to die one day. That's been, you know, pessimistic. You might as well give up now. What's the use?
Right, yeah.
But, of course, you know, what you do with that life is what makes it worthwhile or not, you know. And, of course, you know, and the other thing that sort of regards gives you some type of immortality is one's children, you might say. So, you know, maybe we'll have a post-Western child, or a post-Western child that's given a Russian impetus. I don't know. Just at the moment, Russia seems to be... Well, in previous cycles, we've seen with the decay of one civilization, basically the rise of a new civilization, and that civilization is often started as rather uncouth and barbarian and, you know, uncultivated, one might say. And it sort of swept clean the decay and degeneration of the past and offered something new, often with the seeds of what was best in that past. So, you know, the only option I see at the moment is possibly something being offered by Russia. But
are we getting Islam in Europe for that reason and in the West?
Well, I see Islam as, once again, something else that's been gravely used by the power elites. And a book that's actually due out within possibly a couple of weeks that I've written is on that subject. It's called Islam, Zionism and the West, and that's coming out from Black House Publishing. And the theme of that is basically that extremist Islam was being used by what we call the neocons, who are actually really just bloody post-Trotskyite Zionists.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and, you know, they're using the extremist Muslims, or even also immigration by, you know, among more moderate Muslims, to actually create a clash of civilizations, as they call it, where I don't think any such clash needed to exist. I don't regard it as inevitable.
No, it's artificial, completely artificially created.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we have to look at the cause of it all before we start getting too carried away about, you know, with Islamophobia. And,
definitely. Sorry to interrupt, Kerry. Please pick that up. But I always want to mention that as well, that when I say Islam, I don't mean it exactly in that one-dimensional way. I'm saying it's taking the form of that, you know, what most people, unfortunately, to a certain degree, are going to see in front of their eyes. But definitely behind the curtain, you have a very different agenda. You, of course, have a Zionist network within Europe that I think have a kind of a vengeance, really, on the West and Europe, and seeing this
that's the idea of it. You know, we've got, you know, the multiculturalism agenda, where the, I documented in Babel Incorporated, where, as Muslims, and especially the new generation of youth, you know, this, you know, sort of that have been born in Europe, are being used because they're alienated, basically. They've been used by these powers. And then you've got the other side of the agenda of militant is them actually being backed to cause a scare amongst Europeans. I mean, for decades we had the Red Scare and how the Soviet Union was going to take over the world, and everyone had to subordinate themselves to the USA for American protection. So and now, of course, that's not so evident, although, they're trying to build up Russia again as a great threat. But now we've got this new Muslim threat, which, I mean, that wouldn't have existed if the Anglo-French powers hadn't have basically betrayed the Arabs during the First World War. And what isn't really recognised is that the Balfour Declaration was issued in order to get Jewish support for American involvement in the World War on the British side. I mean, in 1917, things were pretty much at a stalemate, and the British wanted the Americans to come into the war, and they thought, well, how the hell are we going to do this? And because there's such a sentiment against being involved in any such war, and so you got someone called James A. Malcolm, who was a representative for Sassoon and other Jewish interests in Britain. He's actually of Arminian descent himself. Coming up with this idea of saying, well, there's this Zionist movement, and if we back that, we'll get all this influential Jewish support to push for the Americans to go into the war. So while the Arabs were fighting against the Turks under Lawrence of Arabia, on the one hand being promised independence after, from the Ottoman Empire after the First World War, on the other hand, the British were promising the Zionists that they'd have a state plonked in the middle of Islam. So it was completely duplicitous of the powers, and that's really what has created the conflict in the first place. But I think...
And that's the elite again, though. That's the point. It's not the people of Europe that are responsible for that, right?
Precisely. But I think, in theory, the Balfour Declaration could be a good thing. I mean, it promises a Jewish state within Palestine, so long as such a state doesn't intrude upon the rights of the Palestinians. Well, that sounds all right to me. Let's make Israel a shitty little state in Palestine, so long as they don't interfere with the Palestinians. I'm perfectly happy with that. I think the Arabs and the Palestinians would be perfectly happy with it also.
I think it would be better to get the Zionists out of Europe, right?
Well, exactly. Or, they've also got several other homelands such as New York and Miami. I mean,
yeah, that's right.
But, and the other factor too is that, as I document in my most recent book, this whole Islamic extremist thing was backed, funded, and promoted by the US in the first place, and so far as that they, the Mujahideen and then Afghanistan was created by the US to get the Russians out, and then in Serbia, there Milosevic was supposedly fighting Muslim extremism, and you'd think the United States would be all over Serbia wanting to support Milosevic if they're concerned about Muslim extremism, and yet they backed the KLA, So, and now there's rumours and various indications that this ISIS thing, which really only ever shows on television a couple of trucks with a few dozen people sitting on board, they are apparently trained in Jordan and are getting money from US allies. But it seems to me that ISIS could be wiped out at any stage that the United States wanted to wipe them out. But it seems to be a very handy thing to have ISIS to go into any state that the United States has targeted. And, that's the excuse to destroy that state while destroying ISIS.
Yeah.
Syria, for instance, was marked over 20 years ago by the... Project for a New American Century and other such neocon bodies for as being the major target to destroy. And now, sure enough, you get this thing called ISIS suddenly cropping up in Syria and all this nonsense about Assad, etc. And now that's being targeted. You know, it all seems to be suddenly very handy to have these Muslim extremists who are funded during the Cold War in the first place as a, you know, justification for the Americans to yob about the world claiming to be the saviors of all and sundry.
Yeah, definitely. They need that enemy to focus on, and
yeah, exactly.
They do that. And at the same time, the other part of me feels as well when you look at things like, we can get your take on this, but you see things like the beheading of Lee Rigby or the brutal stabbing of Theo van Gogh, and there are a lot of violent demonstrations by Muslims in Europe. I mean, they are certainly a lot of willing accomplices there, if nothing else, correct? Or are all of these staged? Are all of these manufactured, do you think?
Well, I think it's basically like a lot of things. You set something in motion and just take advantage of its natural course. I mean, you know, not everything needs to be contrived. I mean, you just set the thing in motion in the first place, and it is just a natural development from that. And it serves the powers that be, very handily when, people can be easily agitated into doing extremist actions. So it all adds the fear, and in Europe, I guess it's a very real fear. I mean, in New Zealand, it's there's no reason that the Muslims here integrate perfectly well, you know.
Yeah.
Even here, there's talk, there's scaremongering even here from the government about the, you know, supposed terrorism and all the rest of it. But in Europe, I spoke to a chap from Sweden about half a year ago here, and his description of what was happening in Sweden and elsewhere in Europe was quite harrowing.
Yeah,
Maybe if I was living in Sweden, I wouldn't be so, I might have a bit of a different outlook. But, you get people like Andre Breivik, etc., claiming to speak on behalf of the right, and the English Defence League marching through the streets with the Israeli flag, and
exactly.
We're getting our bloody. I think we need to get things into perspective somewhat and realise that behind all this agitation and confrontation, I think the Zionist entity is, as is often the case, sitting back, rubbing its hands and with glee, and having a big tackle at the Muslims and the Westerners at each other's throats.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that here is where the elite's plan of multiculturalism kind of comes into the picture fully, because I think it's quite understandable to a certain extent that if you feel an insecurity about, let's say, one's identity, if you end up in a country where you know that you don't belong, and maybe you're the first or second generation, let's say, immigrant or something, I think there tends to be, from a psychological perspective, a kind of a hardening of the identity. I mean, we've seen, for example, I mean, if you look at Egypt in the 50s, if you look at their clothing and whatnot, they were like, looked very secularized, actually. You couldn't determine, couldn't distinguish it from America. But then all of a sudden you had, when you had an influx of a lot of immigrants into Europe, then you started to get like, a lot of the burqas came on, growing the long beards. And it was like a hardening of the identity, because they feel that they're threatened when they're not, the majority as they would be in their own country. Correct?
Yeah. That sounds reasonable. Yeah. But, I think we should understand what's happening, and rather than, automatically, throw up our hands in horror at the sight of a burqa or even a scarf around someone's head. What do we want on the other hand? Do we want complete integration where everyone
is the same?
You can't even talk about integrating into Western culture, because what is that culture?
Yeah, it's eroded. It's gone, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Our culture is to be accommodating to all the other cultures now, right?
Yeah. And what the outcome of that is really something that's so bland it can scarcely be said to exist. I mean, it really is just a commodity culture, and what is really defined by Madison Avenue or New York or Hollywood, etc., that is not something I really think should be recommended or expected of a Muslim or an African or an Asian or whatever, you know. But it's a quandary because you don't want all these ghettos forming in, you know, in Europe. But on the other hand, why should these immigrants, you know, just adopt the ways of the West, which have become so bland as to be,
well, curse on the West itself, really. I don't think they should. See, that's the point. I mean, the idea here is what everyone should have their own homeland, right? That's kind of the idea here. And if things weren't so destabled in the West, we could have still been at that scenario. But now, of course, it's to balance out the picture there, it is, I mean, the West is being hit hardest with multiculturalism now. It's not at all on par with what it is in some of the other continents out there, and that is an understandable reaction. And I think there's a lot of, you know, problems that arise from that. But absolutely, you're right. I mean, it's not just about viewing the first level of what goes on in front of your face and react completely to that. You have to understand that there's, you know, kind of stuff happening underneath there, and that there's,
yeah, in the
you
background.
Know, yeah.
And of course, in all such situations, you know, even a, you know, Marxist class struggle, I mean, where, you know, the workers are agitated against the bourgeoisie, who usually are nothing but a, you know, small traders and ordinary businessmen comparative to the international bankers. You know, people's attentions are diverted away from the common enemies, basically, you could say the common enemies of the entirety of humanity.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's class struggle or multicultural conflicts, you know, it's always the ordinary people at each other's throats, while the you know, bastards controlling everything in the background, completely invisible. You know, and you know, I think it would be more encouraging to see actions from the right against, you know, a bank than a mosque, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah, yeah.
But that, of course, that's the easy target. You know, a mosque is the easy target, and it's the emotional target, you know. And, of course, the Muslims, you know, as you say, you know, they're being easily agitated themselves and coming out with signs in the streets saying, you know, Sharia law will rule the world. You know, that is not helpful either.
No, it's not.
in fact, when one reads the Quran, you know, I mean, I guess like any religious documents, you know, whether it's the Bible or the you know, Hindu doctrines or anything like that, can be taken out of context. But one also sees a lot of statements about how religion should be based on freedom of choice, and you know, one should be tolerant towards the outsider. And in fact, you know, during the medieval times, commentators did allude to how welcoming the Arabs were towards strangers, etc. And of course, I think right up until the creation of Israel, you know, the small communities of Jews that already lived in Palestine for generations got on extremely well
with
the Arabs.
Definitely.
You know?
Yeah. No, so, exactly. I think you're right. And because those things are, see, there was a natural process by how that occurred, and it was also maybe even a natural, I guess, self-association or segregation, if you want to use that word. And it was like it was a functioning society because it was maintained organically. But in this case, it's just everything is very much artificial, and it's people are pushed on each other, and this is what's creating these conflicts.
Yeah, difference between compulsion and freedom of you know, freedom
association.
That's the big difference. And of course, we have the various human rights and race relations legislation throughout the Western world, which, you know, can only inflame and cause resentment. I mean, you can't impose people on the other. It's like, you know, getting someone off the street and trying to impose them as a guest in your house. And, you know, who would want them to stay if they're scruffy, you know, buggers or alcoholics or something, you know, want them imposed on you to stay in your house. Well, you know,
That's kind of what's happening on a larger scale, isn't it?
Yeah. So it just causes nothing but resentment. Whereas, you know, and when someone protests against that, they're held to be the culprit and the intolerant person and the bigot, etc., you know, whereas the ill will is entirely contrived by other forces.
Yep, exactly. Now, Let's talk a little bit more about the bankers and the situation we're in here. And I mean, I think something interesting is occurring here now, too. We actually have, you know, I've said this for a long time, really, but the classic definitions of left and right are really crumbling and a lot of things are falling apart there. And the associations, as they were 30 years ago, associated with these terms are no longer in the same capacity. But usually, I think you'd associate someone who's more, I guess, conservative or whatnot, or right, with being, you know, more pro-capitalist. But something else is occurring and kind of arising out of the ashes of this faulty culture of, you know, global banking and everything else. And it really is a lot of people that are primarily, just as you say, their prime goal, prime target is to try to detopple the globalization process and the bankers and what role they're playing this. And I think that's a really important target here as well.
Yep. Well, funnily enough, I think that the right is intrinsically anti-capitalist. In New Zealand, and I think, you know, in the Anglophone world in particular, the terms left and right are not understood at all, and the worst, the people that, you know, misuse the term in particular are journalists and academics. For the English world, I guess every, you know, every sort of sector of Western civilization has its own, you know, history. But for the English world, the right, I think, to me, can be sort of traced back to the conflict between the Cavaliers and the Roundheads, and you know, you put the Cavaliers on the right and the Roundheads on the left, and you know, in Cleveland that would be the Levellers, who are communistic, and once again in France, the well, that's where the term left and right comes from as we know it today.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, as we were talking about before with the French Revolution, what we would regard as left and Jacobinism really introduced free market capitalism to France, which under their traditional society was highly structured and based on the old guild system. So one really, you know, with precise definition, I think one could say that the France of the monarchy, the old France, was more socialistic than the France of the Jacobins. You know, they subordinated the concept, well, in the best periods at least, they subordinated the rule of money, whereas under the Jacobins and henceforth throughout Western civilization, that was really the start of the rule of money. And I think traditional society, which is what the right, to me, stands for, is intrinsically anti-capitalist and for the subordination of money. Like in traditional societies where there's a caste structure, you know, the merchant class is really regarded as, you know, the bottom of the scale, whereas in the modernist society, it is regarded as at the top, really.
Yeah,
you know?
You're right.
And Julius Evola, people like traditionalist authors like Julius Evola talk a great deal about the inherent anti-capitalist nature of the right. Whereas, you know, as we've discussed previously, you know, there's this common outlook amongst the left and capitalism, you know, and so far as they're both forms of economic reductionism and materialism. And, you know, I think it's symbolic even that Marx wrote in England. I mean, he was heavily influenced by the free trade English philosophers, and he even said in the Communist Manifesto and elsewhere, he even alludes to free trade as being desirable in so far as it's actually part of he sees it as part of a dialectical process. Because, you know, as we know from the communist theory, one cannot arrive at socialism and ultimately communism until one supposedly goes through a capitalist phase. So
right.
To Marx,
yeah,
capitalism was actually desirable. And He even says that, you know, free trade is the most desirable system of all because it subverts countries, it destroys the concept of nationality, and it internationalizes, and, you know, he's talking in terms of what we now call globalization. So in terms of Marxist dialectics, you know, while the Marxists and the left demonstrate on the street against globalization, you know, from a real dialectical perspective, it's actually a necessary part of the historic process before, you know, without which socialism, you know, from the, or what they call socialism, can be achieved. And what Marx really opposed was what he calls in the Communist Manifesto reactionism, which was a movement amongst, well, it sort of combines royalists and ministers of religion and social reformers and wanting to actually go back to the pre-capitalist guild stage of organization. So you have a, you know, organic society, basically, you know, the organic society, which is to say the traditional society, was based around the guild. And I mean, the guild concept comes really even further back to Greece and Rome, where it was called, you know, the corpus or corporations, and was inherited by the medieval era, promoted by Catholicism, and, you know, was the basis of Western civilization right up until the French Revolution. So, you know, it was the left-wing revolutionaries, including the communists, that basically destroyed those organic bonds which were based around the guild and called them reactionary. Whereas, you know, in the dialectical process, they regarded free trade as something desirable.
Yeah, yeah.
So in short, you know, I regard the right as intrinsically anti-capitalist, and the left as being, as Spengler said, in the service of capitalism.
Yeah, that's ironic, isn't it? Complete opposition. But no, you're right. I mean, listening to people like Julius Evola, you know, he has a completely different view on it in terms of, as well, there's a more of a metaphysical and a spiritual, you know, root to things, which is, of course, aspects that we've forgotten today. And it's very much, as I say, about economic reductionism, materialism, and there's nothing else there, right? The market can control anything. It can do whatever it wants, and whatever it does, it's going to be the best for mankind. And that doesn't just, it doesn't work anymore. We've seen that, and the idea there, of course, is that I think we're going to see some interesting new, well, don't want to call them movement, perhaps, but ideas to kind of spring out of that type of thinking that actually sets itself against modernity and liberalism that we've seen, you know, today. Do you think there's going to be a revival of traditionalism as well in the West?
Well, one would hope so. You know, as I said before, I tend to see the West at its ends, but, you know, the big question is, you know, perhaps something can come after which has the seeds of what is best in the West in it. You know, I think, you know, even in America, which has been fairly destitute of intelligent thinking for much of the time, you know, with things like Greg Johnson's American New Right and various other movements, it's that's great development there. And also there's a reaction against the neocons with what Professor Paul Gottfried coined as paleo-conservatism, which, you know, is, gets back to the real meaning of the right. I mean, the right has been very much subverted by what isn't right at all. It's basically Trotskyism that became so obsessed with the Soviet Union, with the Trotsky thrown out that, you know, even Sadova Trotsky, the old man's widow, ended up supporting American troops in Korea because she thought that the Soviet Union had become more a hindrance to world socialism than what the United States had.
Yeah.
So, you know, that you know, all this crap basically that we see from America is very much a Trotskyite foreign policy agenda, whereas Trotsky called it Bolshevism. America calls it democracy, and, you know, the same people that were promoting Trotsky decades ago ended up promoting the United States as the paragon of a world revolution. So, you know, so hopefully there'll be a continuing reaction to you know, what American foreign policy is, you know, putting over on the world. And I mean, it also boils down to a question of being and identity, and you know, how long are people going to be content with being, you know, mere producers and consumers before there's a crisis in their, you know, how they look on their lives and look on, you know, what might be called self-actualization, etc., and start to reject. I think people are rejecting it wholesale, and I think even, you know, some of the stuff we're getting in terms of a huge revival in spiritualities and even, you know, banal New Age spiritualities, what they're, you know, signifying is a yearning for something beyond, you know, the humdrum, you know, money-orientated existence that's supposed to be the, you know, the end game for everything.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. Well, I mean, we've seen the neocons, you know, exporting their revolution. They will basically, you know, bomb people into democracy that never have asked for it. I mean, we saw it with Libya, and they're going after other countries as well that don't have a, you know, central bank and political correctness to bring all the wonders of the Western world right to their doorstep, you know.
Exactly. Yep.
And that's what they're doing, you know. So what do you think is the, I mean, I know you have the, and I think you're right on the Spengler thing as well, by the way. I think one of the differences, though, here is that the frequency and the length of the cycles are varying, because we're living in a very much of a sped up world now as well. And it feels like the rise and fall of certain things happen much quicker in these times than it did back in, you know, when the Roman Empire was, on the rise and fall. Yeah. And so we're seeing, you know, very much quick turnaround time these days, I feel as well. So we might not be looking at, like, you know, a decline of 1,000 years, but we're talking about like decades as opposed to millennia, right?
Yeah, exactly. With the, you know, of course, with the communications technology, you know, is the obvious one. And, you know, there's even something that unites the companies like Twitter and Google and all these into something called Revolution, or something like Revolution.com, or alternatively, the, it's called something like the America, the Youth Revolutionary Movement or something rather, and it's basically the mobilization of youth through social media. And, you know, this is an actual organization. I can't remember the exact name offhand, but I wrote an article on it. It's called Twitterers of the World Revolution for Countercurrents website a while back, and I also deal with it in the book Revolution from Above.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're mobilized. They can mobilize within days through social media a bunch of hapless youth that will take to the street and create a revolution, basically. And it's, you know, an updated, technologicalized version of the color revolutions we saw in Eastern Europe, etc. And you have this so-called idealistic youth movement being controlled by the executives of Google and other such companies. And, you know, the guests at the conventions include representatives from the U.S. State Department and, you know, other such and corporate figures and foundation figures. So, you know, once again, you're having these revolutionary movements, you know, supposedly youthful and idealistic, which have just been total lackeys of some sort of corporate structure. But it's an example of the way things have been speeded up. I mean, you know, during the Roman Empire, it would have taken months to trudge away to a corner of the empire and try to agitate a couple of villages towards revolution. Now it's right. You know, in mass within seconds.
Yeah, exactly. And you're right. People got to be careful about this. I think, I mean, the Open Society Foundations of George Soros and many of these other ones, they're definitely behind a lot of the, you know, like the Occupy movement and everything else. And they're seeking to use, I think, legitimate, you know, complaints about globalization and the power structure, but they're channeling it and funneling it into the direction of where they see that this wants to go, right? And to turn it into more internationalism and turning it towards this kind of global Marxist state. That's what I say anyway.
Yeah. It's, you know, trying to use a, you know, trying to cure something with the poison, basically. I mean, I don't know whether homeopathy works or not, but it's in this instance something definitely dubious about the method. And once again, I think we can explain that in terms of dialectics and creating this controlled opposition, you know, to create a chaos, and from there a new world order, basically, you know. And what amazes me is that these people are becoming more and more open about what they're doing, on the assumption that the whole world is you know, eagerly awaiting their mastership. So I guess that sort of indicates an arrogance on their part, or what, you know, once again, it might come back to this metalhead mentality of you know, someone with such arrogance, or what one might call the narcissistic personality disorder. Or, you know, the question arises as to whether, you know, these people like the Rothschilds and the Soros and all the others are, you know, all a bunch of narcissists, basically. I think it's a pertinent question to ask.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think at the same time, that is what's going to be their downfall, but they're going to do a lot of damage before that happens. You know?
Yeah, one point about sociopaths is that they tend to be selfish to the point of self-destruction.
Yes.
You know, they think that, you know, they're going to achieve, you know, dominance and control of people, but they don't have, by their very nature, a point of balance, and they just overdo it until, so far from gaining control, they actually lose everything.
Absolutely. Well, Kerry, I think this is a great time to begin to round things up here for this time. It's been great having you here. And of course, again, I want to give out some of the details of the websites and everything else. And also, well, if you want to leave us with something, but if nothing else, give us the titles again of the books. And you said you had a new one coming out here soon as well, correct?
Yes, there's a book called Islam, Zionism, and the West, and that will be available from Black House Publishing. But, of course, all these books are available from Amazon.com and, you know, various other such outlets. You know, there's several books by Yockey that are due out probably early next year. You've mentioned the banking swindle, psychotic left. There's a book I recently wrote on Perón, and that goes into his banking system, etc. And is probably one of the first, or certainly one of the few, books in the English language that discusses the actual ideology of Perón and shows that he was far more than just some tinpot South American dictator. He was actually a very deep-thinking philosopher in his own right. Stalin, The Enduring Legacy, was actually a book in favour of Stalin, which might surprise people. Insofar as, for me, anyone that does such a good job purging a country of Trotskyites isn't too bad, and I take right. the you know, you have to give him credit for that, if nothing else.
You're saying there's certain things we could learn from the guy. That's what you're saying.
And I document how he actually reversed a lot of the Marxist and Bolshevik stuff, especially on the family and things like that, you know.
Right.
And there's Revolution from Above, which deals with what one might call the, you know, the bankers or the capitalist conspiracy on various aspects, including, you know, right back from the French Revolution onwards. Babel Incorporated, which deals with finance and multiculturalism. Probably forgetting what I wrote down. I've also done Fords for several books like T.D. Lawrence's Seven Pillars of Wisdom, which is available from Black House, and one for Hilaire Billick's Europe and the Faith, and one for Oscar Wilde's The Soul of Man Under Socialism, which he articulated a socialism of a different form from Marxism, actually, which is, you know, quite interesting, if nothing else. And I also wrote one on the Pare Harker cult, which is actually, for New Zealand, it goes to the root of our white guilt complex here. So it is a sort of revisionist history of something of New Zealand's colonial past.
Oh, that's good. That needs to be those subjects needs to be addressed for sure, you know.
Yeah. So that's basically what I've done, and I've got, you know, as I say, several projects in the pipeline. Probably next year I'd like to write one on the idea of the corporate state and the organic state.
Well, great. Well, there's a lot of things in the pipeline there for sure. That's good stuff.
Yeah.
And of course, a lot of things are there already. We'll have links to the titles and, of course, to the publishers here as well. And again, one more, I'll just repeat them. BlackHousePublishing.com, counter-currents.com, and also check out arcdose.com. Well, it's been great having you here, Kerry. Thanks again for your time. Keep up the good work.
Well, it's been very good talking. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you again. Maybe we can do it again in the future.
Yes, certainly.
Well, thank you for listening today, ladies and gentlemen. Great to have you with us, as always. We hope you learned something new and that you are hungry for more as we proceed ahead with Christopher Vasey, Marianne Van Court, John Lash, Program 2, Robert Ferguson, and many more. Have a great rest of your day or evening. Stay warm in the December cold if you're up in the north, and we'll talk to you next week again. Thank you for being a member and for your dedication to continue to question and educate yourself. Talk to you later.